Next case, 23-5120, United States v. Pacer. Mr. Kaplan.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Daniel Kaplan. I represent the appellant in this case, David Pacer. A trial witness has one job, and that job is to tell the truth. In lay terms, in common parlance, a person who screws up, their one job is not competent. The leading issue.
I don't understand that.
Sure. If somebody has one job, in the case we're talking about here, I'm referring to an instruction given in Mr. Pacer's trial. And the first sentence of the instruction was, under federal law, a child is presumed to be a competent witness.
Okay, and you quarrel with that?
Yes.
All right.
And the problem, the leading problem with that instruction is that jurors are not lawyers. We're all lawyers. We all know the legal definition of competent for as applied to a witness. And it's not something intuitive, and it's not something a lay person would apply to a person who's performing a certain function. Not the legal definition is not. The lay definition, the ordinary, everyday definition of competent would say if someone has one job and they don't do it, they're not competent. So when the jury is told, a child is presumed to be a competent witness, and the only witnesses in Mr. Pacer's trial, the only ones who testified that he inappropriately touched children, were child witnesses. The jury is effectively going to a reasonable juror.
Are they going to ignore the instruction that it's the jury's job to determine the truthfulness and believability of each witness?
It's not contradictory. They can do that.
They can't do that if you're saying that the competent means they always tell the truth. Then there's no reason for that second instruction. You could argue that in every case.
I don't agree with that, Your Honor. And I would look at cases such as Sandstrom that talk about what a reasonable juror could construe an instruction, not the same instruction, but similar instructions to be telling them. And the Supreme Court said a reasonable juror could try to reconcile, on the one hand, an instruction saying a certain group of witnesses are presumed to be competent, and on the other hand, you're the judges of the credibility of witnesses by saying, okay, we decide whether to credit witnesses, but in making that decision for this one group, we start with a presumption that they tell the truth. That's not illogical. And a reasonable juror could easily reach that conclusion.
A reasonable juror could do anything it wanted. You can guess what they think about every instruction. But competent does not mean truthfulness.
In lay terms,
or any other term, I mean, you can force into a groove like you've done, but I don't think that's a legal argument.
Well, I would refer to the reasoning of the Sandstrom opinion and Connecticut versus Johnson and other Supreme Court and Circuit Court cases that look to when an instruction is intolerably misleading or inappropriate. And what the court says many times in Sandstrom and other cases is, if a reasonable juror could construe this instruction as this improper meaning.
Counsel, how are we to understand? We have to look at the instructions as in a totality, right?
Sure.
So how does Instruction 6, which is about credibility, inform your argument about Instruction 7 being misleading as to competent?
Well, Instruction 6, Your Honor, has general guidance about assessing the credibility of witnesses, and it tells the jurors, among other things, that they were the sole judges of credibility or believability of each witness. A reasonable juror could say, okay, we're the sole judges, and we happen to know because we were told that for this one group, child witnesses, in being sole judges, we apply this presumption. That would be a perfectly logical way to read those two instructions together. The government has suggested that this jury instruction 6, the earlier version of it that was given in Pacheco, this court's opinion in Pacheco, with one modification where it said including the child witnesses, but just making the point you're the sole judges, that that's the same as here. That is definitely not the case, Your Honors. In the Pacheco instruction, the jury was not told that they were to presume that child witnesses were competent or that child witnesses were anything in particular. They were told you're the sole judges of the credibility of all witnesses, including child witnesses, period. It didn't create the problem that we have here. The problem that we have here is Mr. Pacer is serving a life sentence upon a conviction given by a jury that was told to presume the credibility, effectively, of the only witnesses who said he inappropriately touched children.
Well, it's only if you buy that the competent means credible.
Well, and
it's
what
just old enough to tell the truth is what it means.
That's the legal definition in a statute. No juror, unless they happen to be a lawyer, and if they were a lawyer, they were told ignore what you know about the law when you sit on a jury, would happen to know that. The jurors don't know that. They're lay people.
So if what we know that they do know what instruction 6 says, so is it fatal that instruction 6 doesn't have that qualifying language that Pacheco did? In other words, if it had that language, maybe you wouldn't be making this argument about instruction 7. But without it, there's a problem?
I don't think I agree with that, Your Honor. And I may be misunderstanding the question. If the qualifying language is including the child witness?
Yes.
I don't think it makes any difference whatsoever.
Why?
Because the Pacheco instruction is simply saying you judge credibility of witnesses, comma, including child witnesses, doesn't set child witnesses apart. It just includes them within. And it's not telling them apply a presumption to any group of witnesses. It's saying decide whether you believe any of them. This instruction in our case is fundamentally different with or without that qualifying language because it's telling the jurors this one group of jurors who have one group of witnesses who happen to be the only ones who really incriminate in a meaningful way my client are presumed to be competent, which a lay juror, a reasonable lay juror, could construe as credible.
Counsel, do you still advance an argument about the second sentence?
Absolutely. The second sentence, you should judge a child's testimony using the same standards and in the same way you would any other witness. Now, the essential problem with that in this case is that the core of Mr. Pacer's defense was largely based on expert testimony, and not just our expert's testimony, but the government's expert's testimony about how children are special, children are different. The way children disclose and the way children make accusations is subject to suggestibility. It can be affected by repeated questioning. It can involve contamination. Younger people, children, are more suggestible than adults.
Did you offer an instruction to that extent, to that effect, rather?
We didn't, but we wouldn't have, in line with this court's case law in Pacheco, this court said it's not, we don't believe extra child witness instruction is necessary.
Well, did you make an objection based on the fact that specific grounds that you're now asserting?
The objection was, initially, we don't believe this two-sentence instruction should be given and that it's the Ninth Circuit has observed. The Ninth Circuit, by the way, citing this court's opinion in Pacheco, has observed that a separate child witness instruction is not appropriate. That was a challenge to both sentences, the entire instruction.
But you didn't, it seems like you have a preservation problem here, right? That sort of our more language jurisprudence on jury instructions that you have to actually object to the specific, it's not enough to object to the instruction. You have to object specifically to the language that you're then going to challenge on appeal, right? You didn't have a specific objection to the second sentence.
I understand the point you're making. I don't agree with it because if you imagine if my colleague who made this objection had stopped where he first made his objection, I don't think we would be even talking about preservation because he said we don't want this instruction. It's not appropriate. The Ninth Circuit disapproves of it. There's not an issue of competence. And nobody would have brought up there's a difference between the first and the second sentence. It's only because a minute later, my colleague came back and said, I have one more point about the first sentence, and he made this point about credibility competency that it even comes up.
It's your penalty for overspecification, right?
I know this court applies that insufficiency. I don't know if it applies it here. I don't think it should apply here. The Ben V case we've cited, I think both sides have cited, Ben V, basically says if you make an objection, you tell the court what you want. And Ben V. cites the Supreme Court's case of Holguin-Hernandez. And the Supreme Court says, look, if you tell the judge what you want the judge to do or not do, that generally preserves your objection to that action. The objection was, we don't want instruction 7.
Would the defendant have been satisfied with the instruction if it added a third sentence, and that is, in considering the child's testimony, you are to consider any other testimony that addressed children's testimony. Would you have been satisfied with the instruction then?
No. It would start to address part of the problem with sentence 2, but it wouldn't fix it because there's an issue in this case of these two sentences. We have problems with both of them, as you know. They could be read as contradictory, but in Francis versus Franklin, Supreme Court case, I cited in my brief, the Supreme Court says when you have two sentences of a jury instruction and they seem to be absolutely opposite each other, we don't know which one the jury applied. The jury might have said, well, we'll follow number one and ignore number two, or follow number two and ignore number one. So I would say in that case, you would just have a mess of more contradictory instructions.
I understand your argument. I note the last sentence of instruction 6 indicates much the same thing as the second sentence of instruction 7, and that is the testimony of the defendant should be weighed and his credibility evaluated in the same way as any other witness. And there is no addition, say, and remember, he's accused of a crime, and you can consider that. So given that sentence, doesn't that basically take away your argument on sentence 2 of instruction 7, and you're left merely with your argument as to sentence 1?
I don't see that there's anything in that sentence of instruction 6 that gets rid of the problem with instruction 2 about child witnesses, because our problem is specifically about child witnesses.
It doesn't solve the first sentence of instruction 7. I agree with that. But doesn't that last sentence, it's not the last sentence, I'm sorry.
Second to last, sure.
It's second to last sentence. It treats the defendant the same way as the second sentence of instruction 7 treats children. So doesn't that eliminate your argument and you're left with a challenge to sentence 1 of instruction 7?
No, I don't agree, because sentence 2 is taking away our defense, which had to do specifically with child witnesses. This sentence from instruction 6 was about the defendant, not about child witnesses. I'm going to, if I could, just reserve the balance of my time.
Sure. We'll hear from the government.
May it please the court, Stephen Bryden for the United States. This court should uphold the jury's verdict because the judge acted within his discretion in giving the child witness jury instruction as well as the jury instruction on 414. The court also acted within its discretion in allowing the statement of Ms. Parsons as well as in finding that Mr. Pacer's statement to the special agent should not have been suppressed.
Well, does he have a point that competency and credibility are interchangeable?
So that's the argument from Mr. Pacer here. Yeah. And competent credibility, they're just not interchangeable. Even in the lay version of these words, there are differences to them. You have to kind of stretch through a couple different points of reasoning to get from, well, competent means you're able to do something, you're able to do something well. And an oath says that people are bound to tell the truth when they're witnesses. And so thus, somebody who's a competent witness is somebody who's obviously telling the truth. I don't believe that logically follows as a surety that this is what every reasonable jury would think, or even that a reasonable juror would think that. But we don't have to consider that in isolation. And the problem here is it's coming on the heels of jury instruction 6, which is the pattern jury instruction, letting the jury know they are the sole judges of credibility.
Why isn't it fair to infer, even if we apply all of our precedents that we, you know, take the instructions as a whole, the juries follow and understand instructions, that it's just confusing because instruction six uses the word credibility. It's much more sort of elaborate in what it's telling the jury about. And then all of a sudden, instruction seven just uses the word competent. Why couldn't we conclude that the jury must have assumed that competent means credible in this context?
Because there's nothing in the record that supports that kind of a reading on behalf of the jury. Additionally, there's nothing that was
argued. What kind of evidence would support, can you elaborate on that? What would have supported that kind of confusion?
If the jury had asked a question to the court about competence and credibility, then for sure that would raise an issue that they're confused by it. There also could be other things in the trial record that could show that confusion. For instance, if the parties in their argument seem to be arguing with that or against that presumption, that's going to signal to the jury that even though these words are different, they're used in a different context, we should read them the same. But in the closing arguments from both attorneys for the government and the attorney for Mr. Pacer, there is significant, or almost all of the argument turns on the credibility of the children, or at least how the evidence and how the facts go to show credibility. And nobody at any point says anything close to, because they're children, you should presume they're telling the truth, or you have to start from believing them. They're addressing the issues raised by defense about, you know, their allegations of coaching or, you know, lying, and talking about how the facts disprove those, not asking the jury to find that. The jury instructions themselves disprove them. And I think it's even more clear when you're including the rest of instruction number seven. The first sentence doesn't exist in a vacuum. It exists combined with a sentence reinforcing to the jury that in this case, they are supposed to judge a child witness under the same standards as they would any other witness. Now, that does not preclude the defense argument that that these children, their reasons that they're not credible. That's what the credibility instruction tells them to assess. Assess their biases, assess reasons to lie, and things like that. So this instruction reinforces that those child witnesses are subject to all those.
There's a pattern jury instruction on this, isn't there?
Yeah. There is, on the general credibility.
Yeah, and that follows Pacheco, correct?
So there's a little difference between the pattern instruction and Pacheco that's meaningful, which is that the judge in Pacheco does specifically single out child witnesses,
yes,
and include them in the group of witnesses that are supposed to be treated with the same level or the same assessment of credibility.
Yes.
And while in this instruction that is kind of separated into that second instruction, it's still giving that same information to the jury that the court did in Pacheco, that child witnesses are included in the gamut and they should be assessed
that
way.
But it's physically disaggregated. I mean, isn't the jury, what is the jury to make of that? I mean, it's not included, they're not included as one of the subset. They're separated.
Well, Your Honor, they're read all in a row to a jury as a, you know, just a run of information that's given to them.
Is the jury given the written instructions?
They are given written instructions.
Well, so that doesn't matter. If they go back in the jury room, they look and they say, oh, this is
there's something
separate
special.
Instructions.
Yeah.
They're number six and number seven. They're treating children different.
I agree that they are on separate pages and may or may not have titles depending on the particular court. But ultimately, again, it's, or is it reasonable to assume that a jury is making that finding in comparison to all the rest of the instructions, which make it clear that that's not something to do.
Is seven a pattern jury instruction?
It is not, Your Honor.
Was there a record made of the jury instruction deliberations?
There is a record made of a kind of a final jury instruction conference. There appears to have been a preliminary jury instruction conference that's not on the record.
Okay. At the one that's on the record, is there any indication from the government? Is it why they're adding this instruction seven in sequence to instruction six, and instruction seven is not a pattern? Is there any discussion of that?
The government certainly does not claim that instruction seven is a pattern. The government submitted.
Was that discussed? I understand that. My question is, was that discussed at the jury instruction conference that is on the record?
Your Honor, my recollection of the instruction conference is that they talk about the fact that it's a non-pattern. That's part of the argument.
Well, it seems that at the instruction conference, the government wasn't really defending this instruction very rigorously.
The government argued that it was a correct statement of the law and that it was an appropriate
instruction.
Competence
and credibility are two different things. We're not going to vehemently fight this. We think it's an accurate statement of the law, and that was sort of the extent of it, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And you acknowledge that the Ninth Circuit disfavors. There was no sort of litigation about that.
I acknowledge the Ninth Circuit disfavors that, but I think what's important from Pacheco is Pacheco doesn't say that this circuit does not offer child witness instructions. What it does is it places the decision of whether to give or what type of child witness instruction to give into the sound discretion of the district court. And so while this might not be appropriate there, Pacheco tells us it can be appropriate here as long as it's following the rules of jury instructions generally. Is it an accurate statement of the law? Could it be helpful to the jury in helping to make their finding?
Is there any specific child witness instruction in the patterns?
No, there is not.
All right.
Does the court have, you know, I guess I would just briefly on the 414 issue. I know
actually, before we move on, so sure. It's the government's position we're on plain error for the second sentence. Is that right?
It is, Your Honor. Ultimately, while the government agrees that the first objection, I guess, is to the instruction as a whole, when we're talking about the fact it's not preserved, it's because the argument is not raised at all. This argument that this instruction attacks the core of the defense argument was never raised. And so there was no opportunity for there to be any kind of district court argument or any fact-finding about whether this instruction really did hamper the defense argument, whether there should have been another instruction offered instead.
So your argument focuses on preserving the second sentence?
Correct.
Okay, so let's assume either we disagree with you or we agree that the defendant is on plain error but satisfies that it's plain error. Why isn't that sentence just fundamentally undermining the defense in the case?
It doesn't undermine the defense in the case because that sentence speaks to all child witnesses. And as Mr. Pacer acknowledges, the defense's argument was not that children are not credible, and that you can just, because somebody is a child, find that they're not credible. And you know, this instruction doesn't say either way, that you're supposed to find they're credible or you're not supposed to find they're credible. It tells you you have to judge them according to the information in the record and the information in the instructions. And so ultimately, this did not get in the way of their ability to argue the case at all. In closing argument, they went significantly into questions of credibility. They brought up the testimony of both of the government expert and the defense expert. There was, you know, Mr. Pacer took the stand himself and testified about why he considered the children to be not credible when they were making their allegations. And there's nothing in the record that shows that this instruction would have or did hamper that argument in any way. And ultimately, if we're on plain error on that issue, when you get to the issue of substantial rights, there is a significant amount of evidence in this case that shows that Mr. Pacer was guilty of what he was alleged to have committed. This is kind of qualified as a he said, she said case in the briefing by Mr. Pacer, but that's not really consistent with the evidence that's in the record. Mr. Pacer himself gave statements that agreed with virtually everything that SL testified to, other than the moment of sexual abuse itself. He admitted that within a few days of moving in with her mother, within a month of starting to date her, he would massage her in bed before night. He would put lotion on her. The testimony between the four, you know, the victim SL and then the three 414 victims are very similar in the ways that Mr. Pacer chose to abuse them. So in his action to take, you know, act when they're separately, when they're alone, specifically targeting children of women who are not necessarily paying perfect attention, women that he can start to date and then immediately get access.
So,
but they're not, sorry.
I understand that your argument on that there's, that the third prong isn't satisfied. I understand your argument there, but it just doesn't seem to make sense to me how we still credit the government on the third prong when the entire defense was about the credibility of the child witnesses. And this jury instruction is singling out that group of witnesses and telling the jury to treat them in a special way.
If the instruction told them to treat them in a special way, I agree that we would have a problem. But the instruction itself tells them to treat them in the same way. What defense is asking for is an instruction that tells them to treat them in a different way. And they didn't proffer what that instruction would look like. But ultimately, you know, when we're—
Just the existence of the instruction itself is the problem.
If that was the case, it would have been a problem in Pacheco, because Pacheco is also saying that child witnesses are subject to the same rules and regulations.
But there wasn't a separate instruction in Pacheco. It was part of the—
There wasn't a separate instruction, but where you're looking by the principles of the instructions and what somebody's going to take them to believe, there is no meaningful difference in what's being given to them simply because it's on a separate page. Unless the court has any further questions, I would—
Does the pattern instruction doesn't say anything about competence, does it?
It does not.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'd
ask the court to affirm.
A few quick points, Your Honors. The government just stood here and said that the defense is asking for an instruction telling the jury to treat children differently. That is 180 degrees the opposite of what's happening here. We wanted no instruction telling the jurors how to treat child witnesses. They insisted on it, and they got it. That's why we're here. So the government trying to turn things around suggests maybe they're not too confident in their case right now. The government also said
Does record include the proposed jury instructions of both sides?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
The government also said the government agrees that the first objection to the child witness instruction attacked the instruction as a whole. I submit preservation is not an issue for either sentence of the jury instruction, given the government's concession just now. Now, a basic point to make here is that the jury is a black box. We don't know what happens in the jury room. So there's a sense where you have to look at the instruction, as in Sandstrom, as in Connecticut versus Johnson, as in other cases in this court addressing jury instructions, and say, could a reasonable juror have construed this in a very inappropriate way? That's what the court says over and over and over again in Sandstrom, over and over in Connecticut versus Johnson. And in the Connecticut versus Johnson case, the Supreme Court notes that the pivotal concept of Sandstrom is that the possibility, italics, that the jury reached its decision in an impermissible manner requires reversal, even though the jury may also have reached the same result in a constitutionally acceptable fashion. So because the jury is a black box, the government is saying, well, we don't have a record showing the jury misconstrued. Well, of course we don't have a record. The court reporter doesn't sit in the jury room. We don't have transcripts. That's closed off. And so that's the analysis.
Your argument on that point is that we wouldn't, because I asked the government about that record point, we wouldn't expect to have a record.
Of course not. And in Sandstrom and Connecticut versus Johnson, the court didn't have a record. This court didn't have a record in Pacheco. It looked at the language, it looked at the record of the trial, and said, was this problematic or not? In this case, it went to the core of the defense. It told the jury to credit the only witnesses who implicated my client in criminality. And it was as prejudicial as it could possibly be, and it calls for reversal.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you both for your helpful arguments. Case will be submitted. We will take a 10-minute...